Chapter 1, Down and Out in Chicago. I begin my memoir at a time in my life when I was living in a friend of the family's garage in a Chicago suburb in the dead of winter. Living in an unheated garage in the dead of winter in Chicago is not a good thing, by the way. That garage was freezing, and I was freezing. I slept on a mattress on the floor, and I can still remember waking up in the morning and running my fingers over my frozen hair. I swear to God I remember that little detail, even though it happened almost 40 years ago. The other thing is that garages are dirty, and I was dirty. I had zero money, I didn't have a job, I had no prospects, and I was sleeping on a filthy, dirty garage floor, so I guess you could say that I was down and out. The year was 1981, and I was 28 years old. I was good-looking, I was intelligent, I came off well, and I could sell. When I dressed the part, I looked and acted like the real deal. You see, about 2 years prior, my father, who owned a manufacturer's rep business that sold stainless steel pipe and tubing to distributors, had hired my brother and me to work outside sales. First thing my dad did was to take me to Brooks Brothers in downtown Chicago and buy me a navy blue summer weight wool Brooks Brothers suit, some white Oxford button-down collar shirts, and a pair of black wingtip shoes. I'll always be grateful to my dad for not only knowing how to dress well himself, but for passing it on to me. He also bought my brother and I each a brand new Chevrolet Caprice Classic car. He trained me by taking me on sales calls with him until he thought I was ready to make sales calls on my own, and pretty soon I was calling on customers by myself and was well on my way to having a successful career as an outside salesman in the family business. Then one day after making sales calls near downtown Chicago, I went to a bar in the city where an old high school friend of mine was bartending, and he served me free shots of ouzo until the wee hours of the morning. And on the way home, I crashed my brand new company car into a taxi that was on my blind side, as I was blind drunk at the time, and I decided that it would be in my best interest to take off because I sure as hell didn't need a DUI. Well, that's called hit and run, my friends, and a pretty serious crime. I was told later that the taxi had chased me for 3 or 4 miles down Lakeshore Drive until I was able to lose them. I was also informed that the passenger in the taxi happened to be a lawyer who was going to make goddamn sure that I got what was coming to me, and that he did. The next day after the accident, I had my car fixed on the sly, around $900 damage, so that my father would never be the wiser. Then about a month later, I was calling on Central Steel and Wire, or some such company, and before going in, I had called the old man to see if there was anything I needed to know before making that sales call. And his reply to me was your car involved in an accident a month ago? He told me that he had received a letter from the Chicago Police Department saying that my car had been involved in a hit and run, and that he was to appear in court on such and such a date. I mean, I had no choice but to admit it, so I told him yes, and he told me just come back to the office. About a half hour drive, and so I did, and he proceeded to fire me. I was never rehired, by the way. I'm guessing that he figured that since I was an alcoholic and was probably never going to quit drinking, this sort of thing would happen over and over again, so no point in rehiring me. Know what I mean? We did go to court, by the way, and I remember everything got settled in the hallway of the courthouse between the lawyers. I never found out any details of what went down, and I never asked, but I'm pretty sure significant money changed hands to get rid of this thing. Anyway, here I was living in an unheated garage in the dead of winter in Chicago, and that wasn't on purpose, by the way. I mean, hell, a month prior I had a decent job, a decent apartment, a beautiful wife, and a precious one-year-old daughter. But then one night I came home drunk, as usual, and my wife of 2 years had had enough. She had had her fill of living with an abusive alcoholic who had no intentions of quitting drinking. No normal person, by the way, can live with a drunk, especially a mean-tempered, self-centered, abusive drunk such as myself. So she grabbed our one-year-old daughter and left, just like that. My parents lived a few blocks away, and she moved in with them, and they welcomed her with open arms. As for me, I was persona non grata and not permitted to go anywhere near her or my parents' house whatsoever. I had alienated everyone in my life, including my parents. And my lovely wife and I never did get back together again, as she had made up her mind that I would never change, and you couldn't blame her because it didn't look like I would ever change. She had just had enough. Anyway, that's when I really hit bottom and sort of spiraled downward. I mean, even though I was an alcoholic, I still loved my wife and baby to death. Alcoholics do. Alcoholics still love their kids and wives, but our wives can't live with us, and so they leave. When they left, I was devastated. My daughter was only one at the time, and to be separated from her absolutely killed me. After they moved out of our apartment, all I did was drink. I remember I didn't even sleep in our bed because it reminded me of my wife and it hurt too much. So I slept on the couch in the living room. I was miserable. At the time, I had been working for a company called Hitachi Metals as an inside salesman, but I didn't really like the job. So after they left, I just didn't go back to work and instead did nothing but stay in the apartment all day long and drink. I stayed in that apartment until the end of the month and I couldn't pay the rent. So I contacted a friend of our family and told him my situation, and he offered me his unheated garage to live and sleep in, which I did, even though it was winter. Let me tell you, when you write a book about your life, you start to question things in retrospect, such as why our family friend didn't invite me to stay in his house. Why the garage? Does that tell you anything? I didn't think about it at the time, but I do now. Writing a memoir affords you that opportunity. Anyway, I guess it had, I had hit a pretty low bottom, i.e. no money, no job, no family, and sleeping on a garage floor. My father once told me a story that when he was a boy, he and his uncle Sonny were driving around Manhattan in New York one day, and they happened to be driving through the Bowery, otherwise known as Skid Row. And when they passed a bunch of bums sitting on the sidewalk and drinking booze out of brown paper bags, my dad's uncle turned to him and said, "Joe, those are broken men. Have you figured out yet that I had a serious drinking problem?" I was told early on by my father that I was an alcoholic and that alcoholism was a disease and was passed down through the genes, and that his grandfather, Fritz Carlson, originally from Sweden, had passed it on to him, and that he had passed it on to me. By now, I had drunk my way out of 3 colleges, 3 jobs, and 2 marriages. So it wasn't merely bad luck or anything that I ended up on that garage floor, broke, jobless, and alone in the dead of winter. But it was the fact that I was an alcoholic and I was just like those Skid Row bums that my dad and his uncle had driven by that day in the Bowery. I too was a broken man. End of chapter. Chapter 2, I land a job with Dean Witter. I'm not sure how, but somehow I mustered the will to pick myself up off that garage floor, brush myself off, put on my Brooks Brothers suit and go look for a job. It was time to stop feeling sorry for myself and get on with my life. And although I had suffered the huge disappointment of losing my wife and baby, life goes on. And in those days, I was resilient and had the ability to bounce back. You might not think so, but there is a very fine line between a jobless, broke, dirty, down-and-out guy sleeping on a garage floor and a guy in a nice suit sitting in a posh office selling stocks and bonds for a major Wall Street brokerage house. And I certainly would be proof of that. Anyway, I called up a top brokerage house, Dean Witter Reynolds, which was located in downtown Chicago, and I made an appointment for a job interview. I had been interested in the stock market since I was a kid, so why not give it a try? I interviewed with a guy named Rich DeMartini, the Chicago branch manager of Dean Witter, and a very sharp guy. The interview process consisted of 3 interviews. The first interview was a typical interview, plus fill-out application. The second interview was to test the applicant's ability to deal with certain situations with the customer on the phone. So when I got there, I was told to sit over there at the desk with the phone, and when it rings, answer it. Hence the test, which, by the way, was contracted out to some private company. So anyway, I sat at the desk, the phone rang, and I picked it up. And the person who works for the testing company says something that I'm supposed to respond to, but I couldn't get past the fact that the whole exercise was a fake. So I did their little phone test and then was told to return for a final interview at the same time the following day. So I arrived for my 3rd and final interview, and I sit right in front of Rich DeMartini's desk as usual, and we greet each other. And then he says to me, "Brad, according to the company that is contracted to do that phone test, they said that you didn't do well and that you don't have much potential in phone sales," or some such thing. And as soon as I heard that come out of his mouth, I shot back in no uncertain terms, "Rich, no one is ever going to tell me that I'm not a good salesman." And I meant it. I was pissed. And with that, he said, "You're hired." That is a true verbatim story. Ask Rich. The weird thing was, I didn't have a college degree. And I've always believed to this day that whoever went over my application couldn't figure out my chicken scratch mess, because I had listed 3 different colleges with dates and fields of study and whatever other info was required. And I'm guessing someone had just assumed I had graduated. I have no idea if a degree was a requirement to get hired, but the reason I think that a degree was probably a requirement is because there were 3 people hired at the same time. One guy, George Hughes, had a degree from Harvard and even played on their famous hockey team, and if I'm not mistaken, was the last guy cut on the USA hockey team that beat Russia in the Olympics. And the other guy, whose name eludes me, Went to Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, which is as good as it gets. And then me, three colleges and no degree. Well, it doesn't make sense that they would hire those two guys with those credentials and then hire me, a guy who had attended three different colleges and never finished, and in fact, didn't even come close. Plus one school that I attended, Hanover College, I was thrown out of midterm for disciplinary reasons. So I'll always think they blew it when hiring me, as a degree was most likely a requirement. I never lied on my application, by the way. Anyway, by hook or by crook, I somehow landed a very good job with a very good company. By now, I was okay with my folks, and they even helped me get an apartment in downtown Chicago, which, by the way, just happened to be located in one of the very best neighborhoods in all of the city called the Gold Coast. So on Monday morning, I show up at the Dean Witter office wearing my navy blue, summer weight wool Brooks Brothers suit, new shoes, white button-down collar Oxford shirt, the right tie, and looking every bit the part of a stockbroker. From a bum on a garage floor to a well-dressed businessman entering the beautiful offices of Dean Witter in the blink of an eye. Unfortunately, little did they know that just underneath the fine summer weight wool of that navy Brooks Brothers suit was that same mess of a man. When I showed up for my first day to work the Monday the following the final interview, I was directed to sit at a certain desk, which contained my study course for the Series 7 exam, a tough six-hour exam that passing is a requirement to becoming a licensed stockbroker. So every day upon arrival, I'd sit down at my desk and I'd study each of those lessons books that were part of the Series 7 study course until I had completed the course in the required time frame, and then I took the Series 7 exam and passed. I've included a description of the Series 7 from Wikipedia and also a bit on Dean Witter Reynolds. The Series 7 exam, also known as the General Securities Representative Exam, is a test for registered representatives. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority administers the exam. In the United States, stockbrokers take this test to get a license to trade. The Series 7 is a six-hour exam. It is held in 2 3-hour sessions. There are 260 questions on the test, 250 which count toward the final score. Candidates have to score at least 72% to pass. And on Dean Witter Reynolds. Dean Witter Reynolds was an American stockbroker and securities firm catering to retail clients. Prior to the company's acquisition, it was among the largest retail firms in the securities industry with over 9,000 account executives, ranking third in the U.S. in 1996, and was among the largest members of the New York Stock Exchange. The company served over 3.2 million clients, primarily in the U.S. Dean Witter provided debt and equity underwriting and brokerage as mutual funds and other savings and investment products for individual investors. The company's asset management arm, Dean Witter InterCapital, with total assets of $90 billion prior to the acquisition, was one of the largest asset management operations in the U.S. Right after passing the Series 7, I was shipped off to Dean Witter's San Francisco training facility for a one-month training course where I would be joined by other Dean Witter trainees from all over the country. Stay tuned because you're in for a ride. End of chapter. Chapter 3, I Get Fired During Training. Right after passing the Series 7, I was shipped off to Dean Witter's San Francisco training facility for a one-month training program, as were the rest of the Dean Witter new hires throughout the country. That first night in San Francisco, a bunch of us trainees from all over the country, maybe 20 of us, went down to the hotel lounge and drank in celebration, I guess you could say, and had one hell of a good time. That sounds innocent enough, but when an alcoholic like myself drinks, it's never innocent, and for me, there would be consequences. That night, as usual, I was drinking fast and furious, and I was being my typical loose-lips, gregarious self. And I sat next to this very pretty lady who was sitting on a couch in the lounge, and there was also a guy sitting near her, though I didn't think they were together. So I'm talking, we were probably telling her how great I was, and I said something to her like, "I could eat you whole," a term we used as kids when referring to food that was so good you could eat the whole thing in one bite. But when I said it to her that night, it came out, "I could eat your whole." Whoops, I actually remember that little scene like it was yesterday, believe it or not, and I said it exactly like that. Anyway, after I said that, I remembered that the lady and the man got up and left. I guess they were together after all, no big deal. But later it would end up being a very big deal indeed. Anyway, eventually all of us trainees went back to our rooms, and the next day the training program began. After about 2 weeks of going to class, learning all the ins and outs, the day-to-day of actually being a stockbroker, product training, phone training, and the like, I went into the office of the training manager to pick up my paycheck, as was protocol. And he says to me, and I'll never forget these words as long as I live, "Mr. Kerner, your boss in Chicago, Rich DeMartini, will be calling you in the next 5 minutes, and I have to tell you, you are on very thin ice with the company." Just like that. And then he pointed to this small desk with a phone on it and told me to go sit down over there. So I sat at that little desk, and about 30 seconds later, the phone rang, and it was my boss, the branch manager of the Chicago office of Dean Witter Reynolds, Rich DeMartini. And he was very exact and to the point when he said, "Brad, you said something to a young lady in the hotel lounge where you're staying that apparently was very insulting, and she and her husband tracked you down knowing only that you were in town training to be a stockbroker with Dean Witter in Chicago. The man who was sitting there with her was her husband, and they happened to be a very big Dean Witter customer, and in fact just happened to be our biggest retail customer in Los Angeles, and they told us that if we didn't fire you, they would move their account elsewhere. So we're going to have to let you go." Just like that, I was fired long distance, 2 weeks into a four-week training program. I started crying at that little desk with a phone on it. I was in shock. What just happened? My parents, my entire family was so proud of me. They actually started to believe I could make something of myself, and so did I. I'm fired, and I'm fired just like that, and long distance over the phone. That's almost impossible. What would I say when I got back to Chicago in 2 weeks? What would I tell my parents? "Oh, God, you've done it again, Brad." Anyway, the hotel and everything was paid for the next 2 weeks, so I stayed in San Francisco, hitting those great bars on Fisherman's Wharf, and was, believe it or not, actually having a damn good time in spite of everything, and even did some socializing, as I had met a very nice couple in one of the bars who had grown pretty fond of me and ended up taking me sailing with them on their small sailboat in the San Francisco Bay. It was fun. Took my mind off of things. The other thing that I did in those 2 weeks was to make a few phone calls on Dean's nickel to a few brokerage houses in Chicago to set up some appointments for job interviews. It was a bit tricky telling them that I had passed the Series 7, but that Dean Witter had fired me during training. They asked me what had happened, and I told them a half-truth, that a bunch of us Dean Witter trainees were drinking in the hotel lounge that first night that we got there, sort of celebrating, if you will, and I had said something to someone that they took offense to, and it got back to my boss, and I was fired. You know, this was many years ago, but I'll never forget what the branch manager at E.F. Hutton said after I told him how I got fired. He asked me, "Brad, do you have a drinking problem?" And of course I told him no. Well, that was a lie. I then headed back to Chicago in trouble once again. Go figure. I found this next little item regarding Dean Witter's training program in my research and thought that I'd include it. Dean Witter's research department provided economic analysis and commentary, and in 1945 became the first retail securities firm to offer a formal training for account executives. End of chapter. Chapter 4, Dean Witter Rehires Me. When I got back to Chicago, it was damage control, which consisted of lying, squirming, and general bullshitting. Alcoholics have to do that a lot, and we get good at it, trust me. I mean, when you get fired in a training program after passing the Series 7 and before you've even sold one share of stock, it's not only embarrassing, but it's impossible to explain. I just lied to my parents and everybody else about it. "Hey, how'd San Francisco go?" "Great, except for the fact that I got fired while I was there for telling a woman who just happened to be one of Dean Witter's largest accounts in all of California that I'd like to eat her whole." But I got lucky. When I was studying for the Series 7 exam, I got to know a guy, an older broker whom we'll call Chuck, who sat near me, and he took a liking to me. I won't divulge his last name so as to protect his anonymity, but Chuck becomes a significant figure in my life for a few years and a significant guy in this book. Chuck had the title of vice president, and I believe you're given that title if you do a certain amount of sales. Chuck was also gay, though I didn't know it at the time. I would find that out later in London. I guess you could say that we had become friends while I was studying for the Series 7, as he lived just a few blocks from me, and I'd go over to his place occasionally to shoot the breeze and hang out and whatnot. So when I got back to Chicago, he happened to call me, and he told me that he had heard what had happened, and he asked me, "If I can get you rehired, would you want your job back? I know Rich pretty well, and I can talk to him for you if you want." Even though I had a few interviews lined up, getting rehired would delete my termination. I mean, the getting fired by Dean would not look good on my resume. So I said, "Yes, of course." So he calls me the very next day and tells me that I had my job back. It sounds crazy, but it's the honest to God truth. It makes sense if you think about it. They had spent all that money getting me to that point. So as long as California didn't find out, why not? I mean, they did fire me as per the insulted couple's request, didn't they? Anyway, that's how I see it. I was once again a registered representative with Dean Ritter Reynolds. Go figure. When I returned from California, Dean had moved. Even though Dean was a California company, I had heard that this was Dean's flagship office here in Chicago. No idea why, but that's what I had heard. My guess is that they owned the new building and that it was the newest and most modern facility in the company, and it was spectacular. It's funny, but Dean Ritter became a Chicago company right after I started working for them due to the fact that Sears and Roebuck bought them out. I've included a photo of the building I worked in while in the employ of Dean Ritter Reynolds. We occupied those first two floors, and boy, was it posh, just my style. Here's me roller skating to work, which I did every day, weather permitting. I have zero recollection as to how I got these roller skating photos that you see in this book, but boy, am I glad I have them. End of chapter. Chapter 5, I Roller Skated to Work. One of the fringe benefits of getting hired by Dean Ritter was the fact that for the first time in my life, I got to live in a big, fantastic city, i.e. Chicago, and be exposed to so many great and different things that had I stayed in the suburbs, I never would have been exposed to. One of those things was roller skating. When I wasn't working, I would hang out on Oak Street Beach, which was the place to hang out if you lived downtown Chicago, and there were a bunch of roller skaters down there skating along the lake, looking like they were having one hell of a lot of fun. And I just had to try it. So I bought some skates and ended up getting very proficient at it. And in fact, skating became my passion. And so I skated to the Dean Ritter office every single day, weather permitting. My roller skates, in fact, were to become my closest friend in the coming years. And I would end up skating around the world, I guess you could say, including Paris, Singapore, New York, Miami Beach, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Taipei, and Bangkok. Oh, and don't forget that one day in London, Brad, when you skated from the train station where you had just arrived from Berlin to Brown's Hotel and into the lobby to meet Chuck, that unforgettable day back in 1985. You remember Chuck, the gay guy who got me my job back? But that's story later. I've included a few images of me skating down fabulous Michigan Avenue to the Dean Ritter office in 1982 or so. Looks like fun, doesn't it? I guarantee you that I was the only one in Chicago skating to work in a Brooks Brothers suit, and I know that because I never once saw anyone else doing it. You have to remember that this was the early 80s, and people weren't roller skating or skateboarding in the streets yet. So when I did it in Chicago, it stood out. And later, when I skated the streets of Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Taipei, and finally Bangkok, I was quite the item, what can I say? One time when I was skating the streets of Bangkok, a guy from the Bangkok Post was going by in a taxi and noticed me skating, and the taxi stopped and pulled over, and he got out and asked me if he could interview me and take some photos, and of course I said yes, and a few days later, those images ended up on page 3 of the Bangkok Post. Unfortunately, when I was arrested years later in my room in Pattaya for drugs, the police took all my stuff, including my copy of that Bangkok Post newspaper, and I never did get it back. I'm still trying to recover it for the book, but when I call the Bangkok Post to see if I can get that particular newspaper, they need a date, and I haven't been able to figure that out. End of chapter. Chapter 6. Dean fires me yet again. After about a year at Dean, I was sitting at my desk, which was located in an area of the office which was referred to as the bullpen area, an area where the lowest producers in the office sat, and was located right smack dab in the middle of the office. If you were a successful broker, you would be given your own private glass office, and if you weren't, you'd be sitting in the bullpen and right out in the open. Anyway, one day I'm arguing with a customer over the phone regarding his stock that tanked. And he had said something nasty to me, and I screamed at him at the top of my lungs, telling him that I would crawl through that goddamn receiver and kick his ass if he said one more word about his stock loss. Well, everyone in the entire office could hear me, and in fact, it was probably rather frightening. And another broker in that same bullpen area happened to be servicing a customer at his desk when I had my temper tantrum, and so a few minutes after my outburst, somebody came by my desk and tells me that Rich wanted to see me in his office. And so I went into his office and sat down in front of that big, huge, clean, shiny desk of his, and he explained to me that another broker had come into his office complaining about my outburst, as he had had an elderly female customer at his desk and it had embarrassed the hell out of him, and that it was just unacceptable for me to have done that. And then Rich proceeds to tell me that my services would no longer be required at Dean Witter Reynolds. So much for my career at Dean Witter. And mind you, Rich may have been just looking for an excuse to fire me because of my sales figures, or lack thereof. So I was jobless once again and in trouble. My father used to tell me that a leopard never changes his spots, and I had just proved him right yet again. Anyway, I would find myself job hunting once again, and that same mess of a man would soon fool another brokerage house into believing that that professional image of me was me, but they'd be proven wrong, as that dragon would rear its ugly head there too. What's that definition of insanity again? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result? I was most definitely insane, wasn't I? Just out of curiosity, I Googled the name of the guy who had hired and fired me twice, the Chicago branch manager of Dean Witter Reynolds, Rich DeMartini, to see where he ended up, and came up with the following from Wikipedia. I think you'll be impressed. As is reported below, he became highly successful, and that doesn't surprise me one bit. And then a bit on Dean Witter Reynolds. Rich DeMartini joined Crestview as a partner in 2005 and is a member of the investment committee. He is also head of Crestview's financial services strategy. Prior to Crestview, Rich served as president of the Bank of America Wealth and Asset Management Group from March 2001 until December 2004. At Bank of America, Rich was responsible for all wealth and asset management activities and oversaw approximately $400 billion in assets under management. He was also a member of Bank of America's operating committee. Prior to Bank of America, Rich retired from Morgan Stanley, where he served as chairman and CEO of the International Private Client Group. His 26-year career at Morgan Stanley included roles as president of individual asset management and co-president of Dean Witter & Company, Inc., and chairman of Discover Card. He was also a member of the Morgan Stanley Management Committee. Rich is currently a director of Fidelis Insurance Holdings, Protect My Car, and Victory Capital. He's also currently serves as a director of Partners Capital, the United States Equestrian Team Foundation, and is a trustee and president of the Whitney Museum of American Art. Rich has served as chairman of the board of NASDAQ Stock Market and the vice chairman of the board of the directors of the National Association of Securities Dealers, Inc. Rich received a BA from San Diego State University, which he attended on a tennis scholarship. End of chapter.